Okay, so this is our last meeting for this session, and that means that we are finishing up the space section of dynamics. And once again, I think, you know, if I had to, if you asked me which is my favorite TSK book, I think I'd say Dynamics. I suppose we're not supposed to have favorites, right? It's like asking you who your favorite son or daughter is. You're not supposed to have favorites. But, well, I don't know. I really, you know, when I'm working with each book, I really admire each book. But I certainly admire Dynamics. And this chapter is a wonderful chapter. As always, there is a lot to discuss, and I want to make sure that I get to the points toward the end, and so I'm actually going to not go into some of the material. There's just too much to talk about. But we'll have some interesting things, I think. So remember that after this, we're going to have a three-week break, which is longer than we usually have. And I'm going to, you'll have a walkabout assignment during that time, but it seems especially important to activate that. I'll say more about that at the end, or more likely, I will send out a message to people, post it on the web, and probably also email it to people. Okay, that's plenty by way of structure and administration and all of that. I want to get into the text. So I want to start a little differently from the way I usually do, and that is to look at the very last line. So this is the last line in the space section of Dynamics. And it says, space and knowledge prove to be inseparable. Space and knowledge prove to be inseparable. So that's a really radical claim. I think we're used to hearing things like that in TSK in one way or another. And so maybe we don't notice exactly. So that's one reason I wanted to call attention to it. It's, you know, I've mentioned in here occasionally that there's this radical claim at the beginning of the time-space knowledge book, which is so radical that I think it often just confuses people and they stop on page 10 of that book, where he says, space is projecting space into space. That's all, he says. And people don't know what that means. This is just as radical a claim, but we've been kind of conditioned by our previous study to say, space is inseparable from knowledge. But we really need to ask, what does that mean? How can you say that space is inseparable from knowledge? Clearly, you can't say it in terms of ordinary space. Now, there was a time in the history of Western thought when you might say that space, there's a famous saying, I can't remember who said it right now, that space is God's sensorium. Space is the way that God reaches out to know reality, something like that. And that would be kind of like saying space and knowledge are inseparable. But of course, the difference is that they're talking about God's knowledge, and that's not a topic that we are in any way engaging. It's just nice to remember that there are ways of thinking in the West and in every tradition which come closer to this sense that space and knowledge are somehow closely connected. But especially in our culture, when space is understood essentially in scientific terms or objective terms, if you just asked someone who hadn't kind of been steeped in the TSK vision, if you gave them that quote, I think they'd find it very puzzling. And so we may not find it puzzling, but we need to be able to understand what makes it possible to say that. So, of course, we've been exploring that question in various ways for this whole 12 weeks, actually, that we've spent on this, on the space section of dynamics. So I'm going to say some things that kind of summarize and move forward, but they also all come out of this chapter, this reading. So the first thing to say is that if we find it puzzling, if we ask the question and try to do it in a fresh new way, how can space and knowledge be inseparable? We immediately run into the problem that I was just mentioning, which is that space is basically understood as nothing at all. It's complete void. In quantum physics, virtual particles pop in and out of space, but that doesn't seem to get us much closer to understanding the relationship between space and knowledge. Caroline says something interesting. It's a good example. The three characteristics of the deity, she says, are omniscience, omnipotence, and omnipresence. And that somehow relates to the DTS statement, the dynamic statement. Yes, it does. And one way to approach dynamics that might be fruitful, I'm not the person to do it, maybe one of you is to really see, can you think of some of the claims or some of the claims, that's not so good, some of the possibilities that the TSK vision activates, are they operating on the same level as claims that in other traditions are made theologically? I suppose a short answer is to say, TSK is clearly not a religious kind of teaching, and to the extent that it talks about different theological or religious claims, it says, well, those were valuable and interesting, but they don't really go far enough. Nonetheless, to say that they don't go far enough doesn't mean that they aren't valuable or interesting, that they might be worth exploring as ways to get a little closer to what the TSK vision is all about. So that's a good example, Caroline. Thank you. I was starting to say that the difficulty with linking space and knowledge is that space, in the conventional understanding, which of course we're not bound by, but it's where we start from, space is nothing at all. So what could that have to do with knowledge, we ask? And what this chapter does is say it doesn't talk about space as nothing at all. We've talked about that earlier. Instead, it talks about the opposite pole or the flip side of the claim that space is nothing at all, which is to say that there are things that exist. Space is nothing, so there must be something. Something and nothing go together, and the way that we usually in TSK, but maybe generally also the way we talk about the something is to talk in terms of substance, right? To understand space, we have to understand substance and the relationship between the two, and the approach that this chapter and the previous chapter also, they're very closely linked, the approach that we take in doing that is to look at thought. And if you look at the first sentence now of the reading for this week, it's about thought, right? The dynamic, I'm reading it, the dynamic that pulls thought toward substance, or pulls thoughts toward substance, and makes them carriers for the field communique. So I paraphrased a little bit there. I'm just focused on that first idea, that thoughts there is a dynamic. We think, and our thinking shows up as thoughts. And thoughts are pulled toward substance through a particular dynamic. And that's where we want to look. We want to try to understand something. That dynamic is the dynamic, as he says here, that carries the field communique. And then he goes on in that first sentence, and this is a typical Rinpoche sentence because he says so much in just one sentence. But he goes on in that first sentence to say that dynamic shows up in terms of stories. And not only that, but the stories interconnect. Okay? So Michael makes a comment here. He says, seeing the qualities of space in knowledge. And that's interesting. One of the things that I found myself doing a lot in preparing for this session today, this phone call, was to kind of flip back and forth to say, you know, from space to knowledge or from knowledge to space, that you can run it either way and then you discover different things. So Michael's talking about seeing the qualities of space in knowledge. Seeing the qualities of space in knowledge is refreshing and empowering, accessible, no limits, universally present, open, allowing, etc. Although perhaps this only makes sense with some acquaintance with a TSK view of space. Well, yes, we are at the last chapter, the closing part of the dynamics discussion of TSK, and I don't think you could easily throw someone in here, you know, take them off the street and say, now you study TSK and have them read this, you know. I'm not sure that it would make a lot of sense. Ron says, it almost sounds like thoughts become corrupted, implying that thinking in itself is open, but then somehow gets frozen into substance. I think that's well said. I think that is exactly, really, corrupted is maybe not the very best word, but that is exactly what Rinpoche is saying here, that thoughts in and of themselves have a likeness to them. And that's actually a point that I was getting ready to make fairly soon, so let's go to that. Let's take a look at page 65 in the reading. He says, he's talking here about how thoughts can be set free, right? That's why corruption maybe isn't quite the right idea if you think of, you know, being sort of like, something pure that's been corrupted. Can you put the toothpaste back in the tube, as we say sometimes? If that's what corruption suggests, then that's not quite the right word. Or if milk is spoiled, can you unspoil it? No, but can you discover something in thoughts that is not frozen into substance? And I think the answer to that that's presented in this chapter is yes, it seems like you really could. And here at 65, it's the third full paragraph, he's talking about inquiry and how it can do that. Now, we're not going to talk about inquiry yet. We'll get to that toward the end of the phone call. But he says, if inquiry can free thoughts, then he says, thoughts awaken to the likeness of their arising. Since anything at all can be thought, we are free to think playfully and with delight, etc. We'll come back to that later. But that's the kind of key move, I think, that is made here. Thoughts move toward substance, right? Thoughts are pulled toward substance. And once we have substance, we have a space that is nothing at all. You know, it's the opposite of substance. And so it's disappeared. It's not accessible. And the very notion that space and knowledge are inseparable just doesn't make any sense at that level. You're talking about two different categories. But that's not the TSK understanding of space, of what's possible in space. So yes, thoughts don't have to be caught up in stories. He was starting to talk about stories here. And stories don't have to be accepted as the truth of the way things are. It's possible to discover the likeness of thoughts. On page 66, he talks about how thoughts invite radiant possibilities. And that's actually very important because, when we turn thought into the villain, which we tend to do. You know, we just are so busy thinking. You know, if we could just free ourselves from thoughts, everything would be fine. That's how there is a very strong stream of kind of spiritual thought, I'll say, as a shorthand, which says that. Right? TSK doesn't say that. It says you can awaken thoughts, or you can let thoughts awaken to the likeness of their arising, and then something completely different becomes possible. So Ken asked, how is it that thoughts are pulled away from likeness? Is it by treating stories seriously? Well, that's what we're going to look at, I think. But the short answer is, yeah, I think that's right. I think that's the analysis that's done here. We take stories seriously. We let them confer substance. And once we have substance, then the thought is frozen in substance and space, which is a kind of stand-in here for the likeness of being. You know, space is just thrown away or discarded. It's useless because it's not substance. So, yeah, there is this movement from stories to substance, and we'll look at that. Now, I wanted to bring in something from outside, just partly because I happened to come across it a couple of days ago, and I thought it was very interesting, but it's the more conventional way of looking at this, I think, but it's done very nicely. It's a quote from a book called The Ending of Time, and it basically consists of dialogues between Krishnamurti and David Bohm. And in this little excerpt, the starting point is the assumption that thoughts are limiting. Now, that's not the TSK assumption for the reason we've just been talking about. But then he says something quite interesting. I think this is Krishnamurti talking. He says, you're telling me thought is limited. Show it to me. Right? Don't talk about it. I'm paraphrasing a little. I don't get the feeling that thoughts are limited. I see the beauty of the earth. I see the beauty of a person, of nature. I see all that. But when you say thought is limited, I don't feel it. It's just a lot of words. Intellectually, I understand, but I have no feeling for it. So show it to me. Help me have this feeling that thought itself is brittle, is such a small affair. I think it's very nicely said. It makes a very good point, and it's a point that you run into. It's a problem you run into. You know, if you write a book, so here we have a book, right? And the book tells us thought is limited, but it's just words. It's just thought, right? And it's a big problem. It comes up not only in TSK, but although it comes up in TSK a lot, but it comes up in a lot of traditions, let's say, because it seems as though, you know, you have to think about how thought is limited, and so then you're still stuck in the realm of thought. And the reason I'm bothering to point that out is that the approach that TSK is taking, and that I've already referred to, but that we're going to look at more, the approach that TSK is taking doesn't have that problem, doesn't have to have that problem, because within thinking you can discover the freedom of space. You can accept thinking as thinking, you can accept thought as thought, without buying into the movement that where thought is how does it say here, is pulled towards substance. Thought never has to become substantial. But we live in a world in which we're always moving towards substance. And, you know, we've looked at this in the past few weeks. Part of the reason for that is because we're very concerned to establish our own existence. You know, we want us, we want the self to be substantial. And that's problematic in its own terms, but the point really is that we're committed to substance, but we don't have to be. We don't have to be. So we show this possibility. You know, Krishnamurti says, show me how thoughts are limited, but we're actually doing something different. TSK is doing something different. We're showing how thoughts are not limited. If you can rediscover the likeness of their being. So it's a kind of a basic practice, and I want to say a little more, but when we stop and do a practice in a few minutes, that's going to be the basic practice, is, well, what would it be like? You know? What would it be like to let stories or thoughts not get pulled toward substance? Michael says, and this is nice, he says, let me go to Ron's comment first, because he's saying corrupted, maybe, okay, he's referring to what I said earlier, maybe not corrupted, maybe defiled, that's a Buddhist term, maybe contaminated, maybe simply dense, he says. And dense is a word that that is used in TSK. There's this nice word that Rinpoche makes up or maybe restores about the indensification of space. Not the intensification, but the indensification. Any word we use will have some value and some limits. And in general, it seems like it's useful to use new words, fresh words. Because if we use the old words, they have a lot of baggage. Okay, so now let's go back to what Michael says. He says, we're learning a new take on substance abuse. I like that. So it's a play, of course, on that term. Perhaps we can become light drinkers. We don't have to abuse our tendency towards substance, right? Taking appreciative sips of the nectar of appearance. I think that's very nicely put, Michael. Thank you. And as with problem drinkers, we can be watchful of the temptation of thought and its sideway glances at the substantial bottle on the shelf. That's a very nice image. It'd be really fun to work it out. One thing that occurs to me is, and Ron raises this point in a comment below, he says, if you're a substance abuser, and we're talking about alcohol here, then generally, if you look at something like Alcoholics Anonymous, you say, well, just cut it, just stop, just no more drinking, period, because otherwise you'll just get sucked in. And you could say that that's kind of the approach that different spiritual traditions take, right? They say, no more thinking, forget about it, don't do it. Turns out that's very difficult. And one of the things that TSK is actually very interested in pointing out, wants to help us to see, is that we can't escape thought as easily as we sometimes think. I was distracted by the comments here that which are very nice. People are having fun. That's good. Even if we think we're having a pure experience, that is, an experience which has not been contaminated, using that language, by thought, in the usual sense of thought, we still are continuing to tell stories, and that's part of what this chapter is about. So let's go on here. Let's see. So, I lost a couple things here somehow. David offers a... here we go. David gives the exact quote in the chat box. This is the quote that I was looking at or reading to you. I paraphrased it just a little bit. Ron says, there are other kinds of abuse, substance abuse. He says sex is like that. Any kind of addiction, you might say, I suppose. Caroline makes a nice point that there's another play on words in the idea of becoming light drinkers. There's a nice quote in the Dhammapada by the Buddha where he says we shall, when we free ourselves from attachment and grasping, we can live on light. I mean, we can feed on light. I think that's the term he uses. So it's this kind of sense, light drinkers. Okay, so thought can become light, probably also in both senses, or I think clearly you could say both senses are being suggested. How does it happen that they don't? And we talked about this before. I think Ken asked the question, and I think the answer is that stories claim to be about something substantial. So stories are nested. You know, there's stories identify entities. That's what Rinpoche is saying, coming back now to the first page, where he says, stories or narratives let us tell and retell what arises. They focus our knowing. They provide the raw materials. From the stories, and the stories are, you could say, more encompassing than thoughts, from the stories, thoughts can shape identities. And identity and substance are very, very closely related. They're pretty much, they're not synonyms exactly, but it's, you could say you can't have one without the other, because you know a substance, the word means something that stands under appearance, really, right? You have an appearance, there's a substander lying underneath it, and you need to identify that substance. So that's what stories make possible. They allow us to identify. And what Rinpoche goes on to say here, now this is a part of the chapter that's very interesting, very valuable, but I'm not going to focus on it too much because, as I said, there's just a lot to talk about. Stories interact with each other. They have to make sense. They have a certain multidimensionality to it. And so he says at the bottom of page 59, when you're talking about the variety of stories, he says, if you start with physical appearance, there's the molecular level, there's the atomic level, but then you can drop the physical or turn away from the physical and talk about meaning, or you can go back in and talk about causality, which isn't exactly physical, but it's related to the physical, or you could talk about the aesthetic dimension, emotional responses, associations, and then stories about me. Those stories, they count, they matter a lot. So when you explore the world of stories, it's like you're opening everything up and you have this multidimensional set of possibilities. Now that very multidimensionality is what makes it possible to use inquiry, to let inquiry kind of open up our commitment to substance. But we'll get to that a little bit later. There is an objection that can get made when you're talking about interacting stories or nested, stories nested within each other, and that has to do with saying, well, sure, I could talk about something on various levels, but it's really just different ways of talking about the same thing. But, and Rinpoche talks about that, and on the middle of page 60, he says, this claim of underlying identity. So, if I see my friend, but I also see him as being my banker, let's say, since somebody just wrote something about investment, if I see my friend but see him as a banker, you say, well, that's just one person, two different ways of describing him. But that itself, as Rinpoche says here, is a story, that there is an underlying identity. That itself is a story that lets us link other stories. And Rinpoche says that's very useful to be able to do that. But you're still on the level of stories. You haven't actually gotten to substance. The substance itself is a story, and that really is a way of, that's the kind of fundamental shift you'd like to be able to make, so that you don't let thoughts be pulled towards substance. You let substance stay a story. So John makes a point here. He says substance has a lot to do with investment. I like the word investment. We are invested in something. We invest our resources, our story resources. He says, how invested are we in particular thoughts or the realness and seriousness of the world or others' expectations or orientations? How do we stay light and uninvested while focusing on content and being fully responsive? That's a practice. Yes, exactly. That is a practice. In some senses, that's the practice. I suppose it's a good time to say this. What is it that keeps us from practicing TSK? And I think most people would agree that as we go about our days, sometimes we are kind of engaging the world in terms of TSK, but a lot of the time we're not. Right? So, why is that? Well, it's because we're invested in the world the way it is, and we're invested. We kind of understand our investment as requiring a commitment to substance. Right? This is the way things are. That's what we say. That's what we think we have to say if we're invested in something. You might, again, play with the word investment and remember that it has to do with, and I can't trace the connection here, but the word vest has to do with being clothed, right? We put something on when we invest. So, we can talk about vests, the article of clothing, or in more, well, you get the idea. Okay, and Ken asks, says, we often ask the substantiating question, just what are you saying? Yeah, that's a nice example, right? We want to know, we always want to pin things down, you could say. We say, what's happening? What's going on here? Right? What are you saying? There's always a what. We're always looking for that substantial what. We're invested in getting to that answer. And Ron points back to this fundamental story as we saw a few weeks ago and as Love of Knowledge discusses in some detail. There's the fundamental story, I am here, which is, again, something we're totally invested in, right? So that's how it happens that we move toward substance. It's through our investment in our commitment, is another way of saying that. and just since we're playing with words a lot today, it's sort of, we're committed to something, which maybe means we should be committed, to an institution, or we do commit ourselves to an institution, an asylum. And again, you could say an asylum is a place for taking refuge. We take refuge in the reality, in what we think is the reality. Okay, a little bit too much playing with words now. That's at least on my part. You guys are fine. Michael says, substance and identity appear to curtail multidimensionality. That's exactly true. If I see the banker, if I see the friend, I don't so much see the banker, even though I may identify the two. Substance and identity appear to curtail multidimensionality, which could otherwise blossom this side of the zero point. I'm not going to try to comment on that, but it's interesting. While also obscuring non-dimensionality by constructing the fictional dimension of substance. Yeah, everything gets dimensioned out, right? Where space, I want to say something about that, but I think maybe not until after we've practiced. I'll try to, well, maybe before, quickly. It's as if substantial identity takes the place of both diversity and wholeness. And Ron says that's we claim a monopoly on reality. Yeah, these are exactly the right kinds of associations to be bringing into play. Now, the way that happens, the way that story becomes substance doesn't have to convince us. We don't have to be convinced that that's the case, and that's where we're headed with our practice. Michael was just pointing toward non-dimensionality, and I think that is the right place to look. So the way that Rinpoche approaches that in this chapter, I'm on page 61 now, in the bottom of the first full paragraph, he says, stories occupy a different dimension. And that would take a lot of unpacking, but I'm not going to try to do that. But the basic idea is that you have substance, and then you have the story that gives you the substance. And the story is not at the same level as the substance. Right? Now, toward the end of the chapter, and we've looked at this before, we've looked at this idea of flattening things out. So you say, you know, even the idea that story is something that has its own kind of being, which then brings the story of substance into being, not exactly right. But here he's saying that there are different dimensions, and the reason is that what a story does is it creates dimensionality, right? When you tell the story, it's as though you, I don't know, I'm thinking of sort of a cartoon or it wouldn't have to be a cartoon. You know, workers come and they set up their workplace, and they have this thing that's lying on the ground, this balloon maybe, but it could be something else, and they start to expand it. They start to make it bigger, you know, and gradually then that becomes the room. You know, or actually, I remember seeing some cartoon once, I think, where people build the theater. It's the first thing that happens. And then suddenly a play can be performed in the theater. And you can say the story is what builds the theater. The story is what builds the space. It creates dimensions. And what that means is that a story is always creating space. It's always creating the dimensionality of space, right? And the dimensionality of space goes hand in hand with the dimensionality of substance. Ken says, such creation is magical, and it is. And Rinpoche uses that word. It's like you're creating something out of nothing, although that's maybe a misleading way to say it. But I think we're all kind of on the same page here, so I'm going to leave that. And Ron points to The Matrix as an example of that. Right. And the problem with a movie like The Matrix is, you know, The Matrix is very good on suggesting that you know, you can create a reality, but it always has to assume that there is some other reality that's really real. Whereas, you know, the TSK vision is that any reality, any dimensionality, any space that you create in that sense is substantial, and that's the problem. That's exactly the problem. So when we talk about ordinary space, we're talking about the dimensionality that the story creates. And so you can, on that level, you can begin to see how knowledge and space interact, but that's not the fundamental level. There, on that level, you'd say, well, space is dimensioned out, right? And when it's dimensioned out, you lose the vitality of space. So I didn't say that too well, but let me go on to the next point. Because you know, I feel like it's important to lay some of these things out. The dimensionality of space is not ultimately what space is all about. Space in the way that the TSK vision talks about it is not space dimensionality, it's zeroless space, right? So if you have, this is using the language now of dynamics, it's a little different maybe in knowledge of time and space, it's said a little differently, but if you have zero point space, that's the space in, you know, which is the opposite of substance. And what we're wanting to engage is zeroless space, you know, pointless space, something that hasn't been pointed out. And that is where the possibility for the lightness of thought, because you can say the openness of space is there, right? Let me see if I can find... So here's what we usually do. If you look at the bottom of page 61, Rinpoche says, and he's talking about this being magical, that that the insubstantiality of the story is translated into the solidity of what is real. That's what Ken was pointing towards. He says, the mechanism's not mysterious. Stories transform the knowing aliveness of their own dynamic. Now, notice how space and knowledge are coming together here. Into the affirmed solidity of what is told. They enact dimensionality by appropriating the inherent knowledgeability of zeroless space. So there again, knowledge and space together. And then there's this really beautiful paragraph at the top of 62. This translation fundamentally rearranges appearance as substance takes form, the zeroless gives way and becomes unthinkable. He means that very literally. Identity moves to the center of what appears. Space becomes zero and disappears. Mind becomes zero and withdraws. Knowledge also becomes zero, vanishing into the domain of subjectivity. Conventional space and time emerge together with objects that appear in space and time, and the subject that engages those objects, and not knowing prevails. So what a beautiful, beautiful paragraph. You kind of lays out the way things are in the ordinary conventional realm, not only the way things are, but how they get to be there. And he says, you know, when he before this paragraph, he says, well, you know, it's pretty simple. It's easy enough to describe the mechanism, but he describes this in this incredibly powerful way, I think. So, Hayward says, appearances are formed of space and time. We're talking about this deeper dimension, I'll say, as a shorthand of space and time. And Ron points to the word appropriating here, appropriating the inherent knowledgeability. And that's a beautiful word because it has to do with this making it our own, you know, and so on. Ken and Ron both love that sentence too. Thank you. I love it too. that paragraph. And Michael thanks David for the Krishnamurti quote. And he says, you know, this makes me wonder if thought can be accepted as vital and life-giving, but is at risk of being incarcerated by linear time. Yes, and I don't know. I haven't read that whole book. I was inspired to buy the book on Kindle when having read that quote. And the little bit I've looked at it so far, it's very nice reading. It flows very quickly. But whether they move to this dimension, I don't know. It was, let me not go there because we're running out of time. In fact, I'm going to skip the practice, which is too bad, but I'm going to give you the practice to do over the next 4 weeks because we're going to have 3 Sundays where we're not meeting. So the fact that we can't do it now, too bad, can't do it. Because I do want to go on. I think there's still some very important stuff going on. Ron says, take the TSK vaccination? ? He asks the question. Yeah, you know, if you look at Inside Knowledge, the new book, one of the essays that's in that is by Meindert Giesen, and he talks about the TSK as being a virus against reality. So you'd vaccinate yourself with the TSK virus, I guess, something like that. In the few minutes that I'm going to take now, I want to go on to something fundamental, which is another point, let's say, just as fundamental as what we've been talking about, but really important to introduce. That's why I wanted to make sure I got there. And that has to do with inquiry. You know, there's a section here that starts on page 65 that is called Vastness of Inquiry. Vastness is a very nice word there because it evokes this other possibility for space that is free, right? Free from substance, free from dimensionality. It just kind of points in that direction. So you use or you can draw on the power of inquiry. So we've talked many, many, many times about why inquiry is so important in DSK. I think there's an added aspect. I'm avoiding the word dimension. There's an added aspect to inquiry that is brought out here. It's kind of subtle. It's not just that when you ask questions, you open up the possibility of penetrating the ordinary understanding, of activating a new vision, but the asking the questions itself, and we've said this before, but the asking the questions itself is the likeness of thought. You know, we're talking about discovering the likeness of thought. Right? And that's what Rinpoche says in that passage, that sentence we looked at earlier, in the third paragraph on page 65. He says, freed through inquiry from substance and the need to found an order, which is a very wonderful point. Again, it's one of these things where Rinpoche just slips it in a few words, and it's a whole separate idea. But freed through inquiry from substance and the need to found an order, thoughts awaken to the likeness of their arising. So inquiry activates the likeness of thought, or frees thoughts to discover or awaken, as he says here, to the likeness of their arising. Because in an inquiry is a transitional construction, as Rinpoche says elsewhere in this chapter, and I think it came up in the last chapter also. Inquiry doesn't establish anything. Something gets established only when inquiry comes to an end. So it's really important to stay with the ongoing inquiry. You know, that's when you're being true to TSK, and that's why it's so important in the TSK vision that you don't arrive anywhere, right? If you arrive anywhere, you've identified something, you've set up a limit, you've established substance, you've confirmed dimensionality. None of that. You want to stay with inquiry. And Ron says, why does this make me think of modern art? Well, you know, I haven't given much thought to modern art, but maybe you could say that modern art, I'm sure you could say in certain aspects, that modern art is an inquiry, not only into the nature of reality, but you could say, but also into the nature of art. So people might say the function of art, I guess. Okay, so inquiry is this likeness of thought, and it frees thoughts from substance. So that is kind of the concluding thought to the question we started with, which was if thoughts move towards substance, if there's a dynamic that makes that almost inevitable, how can we undo it? We undo it through inquiry, and I'm not going to be able to say as much as I had hoped to say here, but what's important is he identifies all these different aspects of inquiry, right? And he talks about, again on 65, the very bottom of 65, he talks about awaking to the silent tracings of a vast knowledge, lovely phrase, and then he talks about that knowledge as being differently dimensioned. So we've already talked about how the dimensionality of thought, how stories set up dimensionality, and space, ordinary space, is just a part of that dimensionality, the part that's disappeared. Space itself really has nothing to do with dimensionality. So it's actually, you know, very radical. It's, you know, at the very beginning of the first TSK book, Rinpoche talks about how the sky is the local representative of space. And I think there's a preliminary way of understanding that, and then a deeper way of understanding that. And the preliminary way of understanding it is to say, yes, the sky is above, it's vast, it's open, and space is like that too. That's fine, that's helpful. But it might lead you to think that space is like the sky, only gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, like outer space, as we say. And that's not right at all. I think that the reason that you can say the sky is a local representative of space, as Rinpoche says in those first pages of TSK, is that it's boundless, it's vast, it's always present, it admits all possibilities. That's the different dimensioning of knowledge in which space, in which knowledge is inseparable from space. So space becomes something that really almost has nothing to do with our usual understanding of space. And you know, the way that we get to that very different understanding, that, you know, that's kind of the arc of this aspect, at least, of the TSK vision. Ken references Shakespeare. Always good to reference Shakespeare. In The Tempest, talking about an airy nothing. That's interesting. One would have to see that in context. But yeah, it seems interesting. But what I want to point to here, and then I think we'll have to stop, is the different aspects of inquiry. So again, this is on page 65. It's not that the later pages aren't important, but we've kind of settled down here, and I think that's okay. So at the very beginning of this introduction or this discussion of inquiry and the vastness of inquiry as really, you could say, inseparable or identical to, although you have to use that word carefully now, identical to the vastness of knowledge, right? But at the very beginning, he identifies four stages, and this is really worth thinking about. He says, as inquiry moves from speculation and analysis through imagination and embodiment. So four stages, right? There's speculation, there's analysis, there's imagination, and then there's embodiment. And you could imagine that someone who was trying to define inquiry would not talk about any of those four. But we have done enough to see certainly speculation. Well, he might talk about analysis, okay? But we've done enough to talk about speculation and analysis. Then imagination brings in this other element, and then he brings in embodiment. And actually, he repeats this kind of listing of factors, but I think this is the only place where he talks about embodiment. It's very worth asking yourself, inquiring into how it is that you can embody inquiry. And that really, you might say, is the practice, the walkabout that I'm going to suggest you be doing over these next few weeks. Embodying inquiry, but doing it in a way that you know, gives due importance to speculation and analysis and imagination. All of those, right? And Ron points out that in embodiment, embodiment is also important in the first TSK. Yeah, embodiment is super important. It may not always mean like the physical body, although that's important because it's where we start usually. But you have to embody the vision. That saying it at that level, you know, it's one of those things you can say quickly and everybody thinks they know what you mean, but we've been looking at what would that actually mean. So that's going to be our practice during the next few weeks. I'll post something online, but I think also send an email to everybody who's enrolled, or ask Kathleen to do that, actually. But I'll write something up, just a couple of paragraphs, based on what we've been looking at today. See, can you make it a part of your life? You know, I said before, we tend to carve out these little bits of time when we remember, even when we're doing walkabouts, we remember to do TSK. But could it just be a part of your life? Could it just be there all the time? That's worth asking. Okay, we'll stop there. We're going to be taking a break for 4 weeks. I mean, we'll see each other in 4 weeks. And then we'll turn to knowledge, which we now know is inseparable from space. So we're just continuing. Okay, thanks everybody.